Deutsch gets here, we will hear from him at some point in between. Representative Saylor has one of the school districts, which is Black Duck, that has a four-day... A four-day work week. and since we're trying to encourage the Department of Education to have best practices and share, and so that shared services and cost economies can bubble up, we thought we'd model that on this committee, but perhaps he is not here yet. The other item on the agenda that we welcome Mr. Kite for is all the education groups came up with a list of ideas and priorities of how to help us out in this hard time. And so we have MASA, MSBA, AMSDC, and MREA on the list. And if there's anyone else, if we have time, we could listen to them as well. So members, if you could give your attention to Mr. Kite and welcome.
Representative Greiling and members of the committee, I'm Charlie Kite. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. I think the rest of the group like threw me up here on the altar as the human sacrifice. But
you're speaking for all. Very good.
Well, we are going to call them up. We're not letting them off the hook that easily.
Sounds good.
But there's two things that are being passed out to you, and one is this piece that's called Minnesota Promise. You know, here's a quick reflection. Public education has been struggling financially for quite some time. It's not just right now. This has been a endurance contest for us. I see the news clippings every day from school districts all over the state. I just have to tell you, it seems like every third one has cut $4.3 million, cut $400,000, cut. It's been a tough road. The reason I wanted to show you this is, unfortunately for all of us, this is what we should be working on, you all in this committee, us in public education, and this document, Minnesota Promise, World Class Schools for a World Class State, was put together about by 500 folks, large group, if you look at the back of all the different players that were involved, and basically there's 10 recommendations in here that said, if you really want to have world class schools, these are the kind of things you should be doing. And unfortunately, all of us are kind of diverted from this. We're struggling to do the best we can. I suspect everybody on this committee would just as soon be doing these things, not listening to what I'm going to say in about the next 2 minutes. Secondly, I'm going to make the point that K-12 education, even in this current biennium, is serving up a pretty significant portion of the Budget Balancing Act. This business of the aid and tax cuts, it was passed by the governor, but no matter how it happened, it really took about $1.8 billion off the table. And we're not quite sure if or when we're ever going to get it back. Lately, we saw the delays in payments that are just going to start. In fact, the first delay in payments starts, I believe, next week. About another $450 million that we'll just not have until about the 1st of June. And we got school districts all over the state scrambling like crazy to make sure they can cash flow. And I looked at the cash flow projections for next year for the state, and it looks to me like they go negative about in August and don't come out back in the positive until about June. And I suspect one way or the other, the public schools are going to do a fair share of borrowing to the state through another process of delay. So we're making a lot of sacrifice, and we're struggling as we're doing that. But we know that your reality and our reality is trying to figure out how to either just keep the funding about where it is or possibly even having to make some additional cutbacks. We're hoping like crazy that doesn't happen. But we developed a list just of some places where you could have some additional flexibility for schools and some what I kind of call backside levy authority that school districts may be able to use if they really, really are struggling. And I'm going to only speak to two of these, and then I'm going to ask the other folks from the other associations to pick up on a couple of the others. If you look at that the sheet that we handed out, there are two things regarding flexibility in the event of a state aid reduction. And one is, I suspect if we get to this point during the legislative process, there'll be all kinds of conversation about cutting this categorical or that categorical, and everybody will try to stop their ox from being gored, and ultimately, if something has to happen, it may well happen from the core funding for education. That's just a political reality as I see it. If that happens, it is important that you give the school districts the ability to move money from whatever funds they have to try to support and preserve that core. And the core really is having your teachers in the classroom, your programs that you're doing, and you want the money there. So the ability, if it comes to this, of being able to let a school district move money kind of willy-nilly to preserve the core of their operation is something we would like to see. The second thing I'll just mention is that there's a second scenario that could play out. You all might figure out how to get us through next year without any kind of reductions. Maybe you do some other things. Maybe things just turn better. But when we get to next year, if we have any kind of a downturn, no matter who the new governor is, they may be faced with going into some kind of an unallocation process, cutting monies from various groups of state government. One of them well could be K-12 education. If that happens, we would like to have some kind of a trigger mechanism that would allow us to reopen the process for making decisions about staff at some time during the year. Now, we're not crazy about making any of our staff be vulnerable, but let's just say that in 2011 in January, poof, we end up losing quite a bit of money. And almost all of our dollars are concentrated in the costs of hiring our people. There may need to be a way for us to kind of reopen that terrible process that we typically do from April to about June, where we actually ask some people not to work for us anymore. So that's a second flexibility that, frankly, we'd rather never ask anybody to give us. But if that scenario happens, that's something that we almost need in order to survive, at least for some districts. So those are two things. At this point, I'm hoping somebody will come up from the School Board Association, AMSD, C, and MREA, and pick up on a number of these other items.
And Mr. Kite, while they're coming up or before you leave, tell me, for number one there, what categoricals are you thinking of that districts would most like to transfer from?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, that's a very good question, because that answer is different for different districts. Mm-hmm. Some districts may have money built up in one fund that's kind of untouchable. Another district may have it built up in some other fund. So it's not so much of giving specific authority for some fund to come to the core funding, but being able to have them have the flexibility, because there's really quite a number of pots of money that flow to the schools. And that then puts the school boards in the position of making a decision about what's most important. And I'm sure those will be difficult decisions. So I'm not deflecting your question, mm-hmm. but the reality is it's the flexibility that's important, not so much the specific fund.
Okay, then, Mr. Kite, could you name three?
Yes. I'll name three. Maybe I'll name more, because I could feel arrows into my back already. But there is compensatory money. There is Title I money. There is community education money. There is still some money reserved in the professional development accounts from last year that can't be gotten out. There's probably some sparsity transportation money. There's sparsity money. There's integration money. Okay, I could feel like eight arrows in my back now, but I better stop talking.
You mentioned six things.
But there's quite a number of these various areas.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kite. And, I'm not sure what the committee will decide, but to me it would be instructive, if we should go down this route, to keep track of it and report back to the legislature. And if there's some pattern that districts have tons of some of this money just stockpiled, then I'm sure we could address that as well. Mr. Kite.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, there is no money stockpiled, but there's dribs and drabs here and there that we might want to move around. I actually hope that we get to the end of this legislative session and this entire conversation is simply forgotten, because that means that you figured out a way to get through this without having to do negative things to K-12 education. And then that's a big order on your part, obviously.
Thank you. And that would be, I think, everybody's desire. Yes. So thank you very much. And we did ask people to come up with suggestions, so then to give arrows when you do isn't really appropriate. Members, we do have a quorum. Reps and Ward, I think you were the first one here for the minutes. Oh, it was Representative Benson?
That's okay, Madam Chair. I'll move the minutes.
Representative Benson, who might have been the second or third person here, because Representative Benson was first, perhaps Representative Anderson second, moves the minutes. Any discussion?
Actually, Representative Garofalo was actually the very first.
But Representative Benson, he was not in his seat. He was talking, and so that does not even come close to counting. Thank you. All right. Representative Ward has moved the minutes of February 21st. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Welcome, Mr. Kroonquist. Or Mr. Walsep. I'm not sure who's going first. I thought that was still
We don't know either.
Dr. Kite.
I'll take a stab. Madam Chair and members, Sam Walsep with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. I was tempted to be slightly flip about the agenda that said alternative pathways for revenue. The norm for the last decade of revenue has been property taxes. And I think if you talk to the finance commissioners who have looked at the big picture, the majority of revenue to schools since the big 2001 takeover has been derived from operating referendum. And so if we want to find alternatives to the norm, we would like the state at some point to start kicking in some revenue. Now, obviously, that's a little difficult right now. But I did, after I talked to my board and legislative committee last week about this, they did want to make that point very clear that property taxes are not the preferred method of deriving revenue. However, given the tough situation we're in, and once reality sets in, people know that we have to find some other means to find dollars to preserve programming. And I think the group of education organizations came up with a list that I think has been handed out. And I'm on the second page looking at B, providing alternative pathways for revenue. And I just want to, I'll highlight one, I think, that I'll take a stab at maybe a real controversial one. And that's allowing school boards the ability to provide or to renew an operating referendum. And this would be a major policy change for the state of Minnesota. I'm looking at number four. But we're very concerned about districts over the next 2, 3, 4 years in tough economic times who have to renew an operating referendum. And they're going to really struggle with that. And if the state isn't able to backfill or to find revenue to increase the formula, those districts are going to be in a very tough situation. So we think there needs to be some ability for school boards to look at an option. It could be sunsetted in a certain year. It could be limited. The amount of renewal time could be limited. But some ability for boards to at least have that decision in their hands, so they don't have a big cliff effect where they go from $800, or I think the statewide average about $860 per pupil, then find themselves without that revenue. So, Madam Chair, members, I think I just want to make a pitch for number four. I think it's a big, major policy change for the state of Minnesota. But you're going to have to, if we can't get out of this mess, we're going to have to give some school boards some real creative authority to get through the next few years.
Mr. Walsep, I was just meeting this morning with a group of parents from Orono, and they were asking for this provision, and and they're sitting like my districts are with nice large levies. And I said, I wonder if the 10% of districts that don't have levies at all, to me this kind of plays into that haves and have-nots situation that we're trying to get away from with bills like the new Minnesota Miracle. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to me that you are the one, it's my perception anyway, that the 10% would be the districts that you represent. Am I wrong about that? And did this come with huge angst, or is it strongly supported by MREA?
Madam Chair, I would say it's not strongly supported by MREA. We had a discussion last Thursday night about this, and the purists in the group, and they're not wrong, they view this as letting the state off the hook once again for the promise from 10 years ago to pay the full cost of education. Then the pragmatists step in and say, well, wait a second, let's keep in mind we're talking about opportunities for kids. And as the adults are kind of fighting and trying to figure out how to pay for things, let's not forget about, and MREA ultimately falls back on the learner first, and how do we preserve opportunities for kids. And so I think those folks ended up winning out the debate, but it is it's controversial within my own membership, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. And yes, you're absolutely right. There are about, I think we're at 8%, if I'm correct, of districts that do not have operating referendum in place. A handful of those have chosen not to even try for referendum, so there is an issue there. But there are a handful of districts that have tried repeatedly to pass referendum and cannot. So that provision would not help those districts. And yes, those are primarily in Greater Minnesota.
And Mr. Walstis, are these in priority order, the 1 through 5 under B?
It's a good question, Madam Chair. I don't know that they are. I don't think that they are.
Mr. Kroonquist is shaking his head no. Should we go to him, or are you finished, Mr. Walseth?
Take the heat off me for a minute, Madam Chair.
Mr. Kroonquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. I appreciate the opportunity to offer a few thoughts. I'd like to start by rehashing, I guess, a few numbers that I shared with the committee last week, because I think it's an important context. And that it highlights the times we're in. I think the times we're in are going to hopefully call on all of us to look at doing things a little bit differently, or looking at positions that maybe we haven't been receptive to in the past, to take a new look at them in light of the current state budget situation. And the scary numbers, I think, are dealt by Enium. I mean, we all got the updated forecast today, and while the news was a little bit good for the current biennium, the news got even worse for the next biennium, and it's got scary worse. Mm-hmm. The 33 districts that I represent in the 7-county metropolitan area, in the current year, so these are, I'm giving you figures now that are not projections, these are actions that have occurred. They reduced their budgets by $85 million this year and laid off just about 900 staff. All right, so again, these are actions that have been taken, jobs that have been lost. Those same districts, we've asked them to project, now this is a projection, to look at what it looks like going into next year, 2010-11 school year, and we asked them to assume current law. And I think you all know that current law is no further cuts, no further shifts, it's just it's flat funding and dealing with the unallotments that were already issued last spring. They're projecting just about $150 million in reductions next school year. So that's just the reality we're facing under current law. We think in light of that, and I would turn, I guess, to the second page of the handout, in light of that, we have to look at some alternative revenue sources for our school districts just to survive, just to really get through the next few years. I would say that you asked, Madam Chair, about order of priority. I don't think the group really listed them in an order of priority, but I would say that the top two for us would be number one and number four. Number one, granting your locally elected school boards some levy authority. If it has to be limited, if it needs to be temporary just to get us through the next couple of years, fine. We actually think it probably should be something that should be ongoing. You all know that your elected school boards are basically the only locally elected or elected officials in the state of Minnesota that don't have some measure of levy authority. And we think that's a situation that really should be rectified on an ongoing basis, but we'd certainly take it even on a temporary basis. And then number four, as Mr. Walseth referenced before, it looks like we're going to be in a situation in the next couple of years where funding is going to be very tough coming from the state. If you add on top of that a district losing a renewal of an operating referendum, it will be, I don't think catastrophic is an overstatement. It will be unbelievably difficult for those school districts. So, and this actually would be going retroactive. It really would not be new policy. State policy would be going back to old state policy when referendums, once they were approved, were approved in perpetuity. It wasn't until the 90s that the legislature passed the law that put a 10-year limit on those referendum. So we got more testifiers. I'll leave it at that, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you for your time.
Yes, speaking of that, Mr. Kukas, was number four there, with what you're proposing, are you proposing that to be time limited or permanent?
Yes. Madam Chair, we take either. And we think it should be an ongoing policy, but at a minimum, to get us through this crisis, if the committee is not comfortable making it an ongoing change, at least look at getting us through this budget crisis.
We're in really bad shape when you guys all agreed on this list, Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell from Schools for Equity and Education. Looking at the first page, I just would to pick up a couple of points and to go a little further with them. I've kind of made up my own term for another set of items that go along with mandates, and those are things I call amplifiers. And that would be something that would be, say, for instance, a way that we would that would take a current mandate but would kind of make that a bigger problem. Something where more kids would be identified for special ed, for instance, or something due to some policy that the legislature would take. And I think we need to look at those as well, because there's mandates and then there's the things we all want to do, but then sometimes the procedures that the legislature adopts would say, well, it's, you know, we're pushing kids one way or the other, and sometimes we get them into the higher cost areas. The other thing I would say, and I'll let Ms. Allswager get an axe instead of an arrow, I think that there are times when, in this time, that we look at the January 15th deadline, and when we're in this tight of fiscal tightness, in these times of fiscal tightness, I think that it should just flat out suspend the January 15th deadline the way that it was done, I think, back in 2005 or 2003. I can't remember which one it was. But I think that when we're in times like this, we've had several districts that are members of C, and I think several, I think about 20 or 30 districts statewide, that went down to the wire and went beyond the wire, and they were trying to be fiscally responsible in doing that. And I think when you get backed up against the wall like this, I think it's very, very difficult for school boards to say, we're not going to agree with something that we really can't afford. And I think that there are times when we need to say that if the state's in this level of fiscal difficulty, that the January 15th would not apply. So I'm sure Ms. Allswager will be talking with me later. On the second page with the levies, I'm probably the person who gulps the most when the word discretionary levy comes out, and I think that there's a lot of different angles to that. The one angle that I would add is that we've had several districts in the last year that passed levies, and passed levies after having levies just absolutely crushed in previous years, and they finally got to a level that they could pass a levy. They probably would not be able to use a discretionary levy, but at the same token, when you're starving, it's hard to complain about the menu. And I think that's, as we look forward to this, we would prefer, I think, and see that discretionary levy be kind of limited to specific causes. We know that there's not going to be equalization in the short term. I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but then also for some given term of time as well. So whatever you can do to zero in on things in specifics for specific items, hopefully someday getting a pledge of some measure of equalization, and then also making it for a period of time makes it's easier to swallow, but still for schools and equity and education, we need to wash it down with something. On the number four, I think that there are ways that can be done. The renewing the levy, I think that it's a policy that's a different, I would kind of would say in response to your previous question to Mr. Kroonquist, that perhaps again when you hit certain triggers at the state that folks can renew levies for a time certain as opposed for a time forever. I think that those are things I think we would be open for as well. But looking at numbers of twos and three, we're talking about local tax levies for specific purposes. Again, we would love to have the equalization, but my guess is you don't have a printing press for state money up in your office, and if you do, please let us know.
Yeah, we'd love to have one.
But I guess the point is that we're going to be coming in, I think, to a property tax, a real time of property tax disparity again in the near future. And I think as we look forward, as we probably come out of this era of fiscal tightness, that we're going to be looking at where the levies are at. And I think it's time to revisit where we were 40 years ago and not just 10 years ago. And we talk about the old Minnesota miracle. So there are parts of the new Minnesota miracle that are probably going to have to mimic that in terms of what is the right base for the property tax, what's the, you know, kind of the link between income and property taxes, how do we make all those things work together to make sure that those disparities between both income and property differences are addressed in the property tax and the local levy portion of the system, and we're certainly open to that. That's not going to be happening this year, but I think it's something as we move forward that we have to keep our eye upon. So thank you.
Ms. Schwab.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Grace Kelleher with the Minnesota School
Board. Kelleher, sorry.
That's okay. It works both ways. I'm here representing the School Boards Association. They are locally elected officials from around the state. They have been working, I would say, as the state's banker for the last year, and school districts really want out. And we need either a promise or a miracle or some kind of future to go forward from this point. When we're looking at budget deficits in this year, it propels a list like the one in front of you. I'm going to mention the pension levy. Cities and counties have the authority to levy additional dollars for either PERA or MSRS portions that go up in that bill. School districts are not allowed to do that. So if there is an inherent employer cost, they talk about 2% of payroll a lot of times, that has to come out of the school district's general fund to cover that. As you're familiar, everybody's pension fund, and especially the states, are not doing well this year. They are underfunded, and TRA is on the brink of bankruptcy in 2032. We feel very strongly that you need to help us in maintaining that commitment to staff going forward. I'm also here to talk about flexibility for kids. January 15th is high on my board members' list for getting rid of. We like to call it our Super Saver 7. It tops the list. And we spent $2 million of school district education funds this year because adults didn't agree. That was not money that went back into education or went for a specific educational program. It went to the state's general fund. And that is just wrong. We fight so hard to get it into this place that it should leave and pad the state's general fund is silly, and we'd like to see a change. Hours to days. Present state law requires we maintain a certain level of days based on 1996, whatever anybody had at that point. We think that is archaic and not beneficial to school districts, and we would prefer an hour designation in that. That would allow us more flexibility in the day in providing services to our students going forward. And, Madam Chairman, we do agree with the list in front of you, but I like to think of it as an emergency list. What to do, in fact, if the child isn't breathing, and if, in fact, you cut our general ed aid, and we get raised to the top, and we're required to increase our student achievement, local school boards are going to need a toolkit of available options in their own local district to use, and we are going to look at you, for you, for guidance and leadership on these issues. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kelleher. Don't see any members with questions, so I'm just Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I don't know how many more testifiers we have, but I appreciate this plan I see here, but it's way too short-term and way too limited. There is no way into the future that we're going to be able to raise enough revenue, whether or not it's income tax or property tax, to pay for these things and keep the same level that we need to have. And so, I mean, I think, and this is what I would challenge all of these groups to do, is to come up with an idea or ideas of redesign, where how can we at least maintain, hopefully increase student achievement, because that's the bottom line, at a better price. That's the only way. We've got to start thinking outside the box, because people can't pay property taxes either. And I understand where school districts are coming from. I really do, and it's very, very difficult. But these scenarios will not, I mean, this budget, which in the long term is even bleaker than it was yesterday, it's going to be bleak for not just the next biennium, but probably several to follow. It's going to be a very slow recovery. And even when we come out of it, our weak, softer revenue base with our prime earners going, baby boomers retiring, is not going to be there. Well, health care and everything else is going to take the rest of the budget. You know, we talked about January 15th. If these groups were to come back with an overall, I've never been for changing the January 15th date. But I wouldn't, if groups came back with a plan, a redesign plan on, you know, start thinking about, you know, how long we need to keep kids in school. I mean, right now it's seat time. You know, maybe it's just once they meet the standards, they're off and about. And I've talked to other superintendents who have thought about this. But if you were to come back with a redesign plan in its totality with January 15th in it or out of it, I would support something like that. We need to start, and things that we might hold sacred or whatever, we've got to all step outside the box and supporting these things. That's the only way. And you know, it's local units of government. It's every health care, every single group. As long as the bottom line is high student achievement, I really don't care how we get there. But one thing is we have to get there at a much less cost if we're going to maintain that high quality of service in our schools. And so I mean, I really appreciate all these efforts, and I'm not saying I necessarily strongly disagree with any of them, but they don't get us to where we need to be in the long term, and that's what we should be doing right now. And I guess I would challenge all these groups to come forward with a redesign plan. Just throw it out there and see what we could do to get better value for the dollar. Thank you, Madam Chair.
This is from our Property Tax Committee Chair, I'm sure we all know. Representative Depke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask Mr. Lundell a question on number four of the alternative pathways to revenue. That's the allow the school board process for a renewal of an existing operating levy rather than requiring an election. I want to make sure I heard you correctly, are the existing, the current system of going out for a operating levy renewal, is that currently equalized? Local levies?
Madam Chair, Representative Depke, referendum levies are equalized fully equalized up to $700 per pupil and then partially equalized up to the cap. And that's determined by the measure of property wealth within each district. So these renewals would be, you know, subject to the statewide equalization that's in place, the statewide equalization rates and amounts that each district would be equalizing at. I think that the bill that I believe it's Senator Betzold, I don't know who's carrying it in the House, would have it at if you're adding a nickel or a penny to your levy authority, you would have to go to the voters. You could only levy, you could only renew at the amount for which you are, for which that current expiring levy would be the amount of that. So if you were saying if you had $600 and you wanted to go for $650, you would have to go to the voters for not only the $600 but also the additional $50.
Right, but you're suggesting what you're saying is that if a local school board wanted to renew their current levy at the same rate that it was renewed for the previous 10 years, and that levy is equalized, then the school board would continue not only to the levy on their local constituents for their own school district, but it would be equalized throughout the state as well.
Mr. Lundell.
Madam Chair, that I just understand what this provision would mean is that all current law
elements would roll through, so that if you are equalized, say, at 25% state aid, 75% local levy, of course, that amount goes down as property wealth grows, so it could be, you know, it'll be zero and 100 at some juncture.
And that is a state law. It's not something each district decides.
Right, that's state.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate your patience in just reiterating that for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I just want to thank the school groups. And I apologize to Representative Demmer and to Representative Marquardt. They heard the speech earlier today about the difficulty we face in the current budget situation. And I just, it's very refreshing to see people coming forward and instead of throwing rocks at solutions that have been proposed, to actually come forward with ideas. And I respect the fact of how painful that is to do that. And it's just, it's very nice to see it. All the choices that we have before us this year, and especially in the fiscal years 12 and 13, they're all bad. None of them are good. There's nothing easy. There's nothing popular. We've got some incredibly difficult choices to make. And I very much want to say that I appreciate you guys coming forward and doing this. My comment would just be that to the degree that we're providing more discretion on the revenue side, that we make sure that it is balanced, that if you're going to be giving discretion to raise revenue, then let's give school boards more discretion to spend less. That would be the principal issue I'll be watching as legislation moves forward. But again, thank you very much for actually stepping up and offering solutions.
Representative Van Zels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's accurate to reach the conclusion based on the testimony that I've heard so far that the frustration is so great that well-meaning, smart people representing segments of public schools are willing to exacerbate even further this slope we're on of going back to terribly unequal opportunities from district to district to district based on tax capacity, property wealth, and a whole bunch of other factors that Representative Marquardt understands a heck of a lot better than I do. Having said that, I understand why you're advocating those policies. The one conflict that haunts me with regard to at least the top two-thirds of the state is, in somebody's wisdom back a few years ago, you all decided to take seasonal recreational property taxes away from levies for public schools. And that was really a horribly bad decision. And I wasn't here when you all made it, so I can be critical of it. And I'm interested if any of you, in your rush to advocate more flexibility and more ability for boards of education to depend more and more on the property taxes, have you would you consider trying to repeal or support repealing that provision as a way of bringing about a little more of a chance for those districts?
Representative Van Zels, before the answer, I'm very glad that you brought that up, because I was here when that passed, and it was the property tax reform of 2001, which I did support. It was a lot less property taxes, a lot more state money. We haven't kept up with our end of the deal, so it hasn't worked out very well, which is why we're now looking at options like this, and to me, Utopia would be the new Minnesota miracle. But the the commercial industrial originally was standing by itself, and it was supposed to be kind of a way if schools didn't have enough money that the state could levy a statewide property tax for commercial and industrial. And after that was passed, the cabin owners were added in there, is my recollection. And I have a clear memory of bringing forward a bill to raise the commercial, industrial, and the cabin owners tax, because that was always supposed to be the safety valve. If we didn't provide enough state money, instead of going to homeowner property taxes, we were going to go to commercial, industrial, and cabin owners, because they got quite a deal in 2001. Quite a deal. But I remember being drawn and quartered by both the cabin owners and the business community for coming forward with that mode of funding, and no one, to my knowledge, has suggested it since. But I am too interested in why these people, these groups, didn't come forward with it. So I'm going to listen with great interest to the answer. Mr. Walseth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Member Sam Walseth, MREA. MREA would support putting seasonal rec back on the operating referendum base. I think when we were putting this list together, there was a presumption that, one, the list shouldn't cost the state any money because you have no money, so we didn't want to bring you proposals that were hopeless. And presumably, if you were going to put it back on the operating referendum base, it would come out of that statewide tax base. No, not necessarily, although I think those folks would have a strong opinion about that. But if that were the trade-off, it would actually cost the state money. But from MREA's point of view, and to the previous question, Madam Chair, about those 8% of districts who can't pass an operating referendum, I've got a couple that are specifically, it's a battle over between the cabin owners and the residential property owners on a lake. And there's a little district called Pelican Rapids up in, I'm trying to think of whose district, is it Representative Marquardt, or is it?
Representative Nornis. I used to have that
That little district is struggling. I think they're about 0-4 right now on trying to pass a referendum. Talk about transferring fund balances. The teachers gave back the staff development money. I mean, they've already done these. They've done everything they can, and they're down to the bare bones about questioning whether or not that district's going to be around. And it comes down to local perceptions about who's paying a fair share. And as much as the superintendent tries to explain to the residents in town that the cabin owner is paying into a statewide tax base, that just doesn't sell on a referendum campaign. They're just not buying it. So we would like that MREA would support putting seasonal rec back on.
How about CNI?
I suppose we'd support that too, although that one's been to be honest, we haven't really discussed that one in much depth. It hasn't been as hot button an issue as the seasonal rec property.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Lundell.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Van Zels, the Schools for Equity and Education doesn't have a lot of districts with the high levels of commercial industrial property, but I'm familiar with the issue, and I think that I would say that in the vein that of my comments earlier, as part of the new Minnesota miracle, we're going to have to put everything on the table. And I think that CNI, seasonal rec, all those, you know, whether we have a general ed levy, you know, how that general ed levy is fashioned, all of those things have to be on the table. And I think that I know that I think it's Cook County Schools goes from a district that's right about at the equalizing factor to one of the richest districts in the state in terms of property wealth when you take the seasonal rec and put that back on the tax base. And you see these great changes in revenue standing or property wealth standing based on, you know, where those properties fit in the whole scheme of things. Just to pick up on, you know, if it's, you know, with the permission of the chair, just to pick up on Representative Marquardt's comments from earlier, you know, if I won the Mega Millions, I could give you a plan tomorrow, but I've got to work for a few more years, so I can't come up with it. But I think that everyone on this side of the table understands that there's going to have to be some massive changes. I think of things like dual enrollment, where you've got you know, kids doing PSEO and still schools getting money, things like that. Those are the kinds of things where we're going to have to really start looking at is students a student, where is the student spending his dollars, all those types of things are going to have to be part of a big discussion. But, you know, we're kind of hamstrung too, because, you know, we see, you know, another 200-300 bills going to the education committees this year, and that we have to react to. And so there's a lot of people that are adding things to a system that we would sometimes like to change, or we see that. And so I think that and that's kind of where we're at. And I don't know where we're ever going to find the place where
the 10 wise people can go up to the mountaintop and come back down and say, this is what the new system's going to look like. And but we do need to do that. I don't think there's any question about it. And what Representative Mansell said earlier about the changing nature of, you know, property tax disparities and all of those things that are in place, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, I really want to credit Representative Greiling for really coming forward and pushing on the New Minnesota Miracle that's brought us all to the table looking at ways to make the system work better. And there are things that I think every one of us would like to have discussed and looked at in conjunction with that. And I would hope that the folks across the street would start picking up at least a couple of the bones of that skeleton and start, you know, getting into that discussion. It's going to take, you know, 4 million voices in Minnesota to tell us what we're going to have to do. And that's going to be people that are in the system, people who are out of the system, people who are retirees, and everyone else that's in the game is going to have to say, what do we want to do with our education system? From my perspective, and doing this for a long time, education is the one thing you can guarantee a kid. It's the one thing you can guarantee a citizen coming through the system, is that we're going to give you the education, we're going to give you the tools to compete. We're going to make sure that starting line for the rest of your life is going to be the starting line that's going to give you the chance to get to where you need to get to. To me, and that to me means, and you know, my good friends in the health and human service communities will be, you know, boiling tar and plucking chickens when they hear that I say this, but we need to really look at what else is in the state budget and what we can guarantee people beyond an education. And I'm very passionate about that, and I think that that's, education is the one thing we can guarantee our citizens, and we have to do that first.
Thank you, and we like that passion. And I keep telling every group that comes forward, every other area of the budget has their dedicated funds except for education. And we've gone, because they skim off the top with the dedicated funds, from 42% of the budget in my time here to 37%, soon to be 36%. So we're slipping. We're not even staying where we are. Here's what we're going to do, members. Representative Dabney has a question. And then Education Minnesota, which was not part of this group, these recommendations come from the five organizations that we've just heard from, has asked to talk. And then our item that was first on the agenda is now here, Representative Saylor and the superintendent from Black Duck, who we were going to start with them, but now we'll do them second, have one of the ideas that Representative Marquardt is asking for that is saving them money. And so we want to highlight that. But we'll go first to Representative Dabney, then Education Minnesota, and then our testifiers from Black Duck. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wendell sparked this with one of his comments. I learned over the weekend, I believe it's in Missouri, a state legislator there has introduced legislation that reduces the governor's salary by, if I remember correctly, $2 a month. And that $2 is then directed to the purchase of lottery tickets. And if the state wins with their $2, the state wins. And I'm wondering if Mr. Wendell, if the the districts that you represent would be interested in seeing optional, it would be local control, of course, ability for school districts to reduce superintendent's salaries by, say, you know, $2 a month or $2 a paycheck, and investing that in the state's lottery.
Madam Chair, I was busy daydreaming, and I didn't hear the Representative Dabney.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Mr. Wendell, I'm crushed.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I get loquacious with my friends in the audience, and I, you know, sometimes, and I'm bad. I'm pretty much deaf in this ear, okay. So I can't.
Madam Chair, Mr. Wendell, if you can turn your face that way, then we'll try it again. Apparently, in Missouri, legislators introduced legislation to reduce the governor's salary by $2 a month, and reinvest those $2 into lottery tickets. And so if the state wins with its purchase of lottery tickets, that money would go in, presumably, to the state's general fund. And I'm wondering if the C districts would support a proposal to allow them, on a local option basis, to reduce superintendent's salaries by $2 a month, $2 a paycheck, invest those funds into the state's lottery, and if they win, they win big.
Well, that wasn't really worth it once, but...
I didn't ask to do it again.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I'll have to poll my legislative committee, half of which is comprised of superintendents, and my guess is it'll fail on a tie vote.
Madam Chair.
Education Minnesota, Ms. Allswiger. Thank you, Mr. Lindell.
It's a form.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota. What a day. You know, I think we should all take a deep breath. Because all of us are trying to rush to figure out what kind of solution we can have to fix this budget deficit. And I just ask you to think about your short-term decisions and what long-term implications they have. Because we're talking about changing a system, we're talking about changing things for kids, for employees. So let's just take a deep breath. Educators right now are feeling like the budgets are being balanced on their backs. And I would guess the kids feel the same way. Why do the kids feel that way? Because their classes are huge, they have old textbooks. Some of these proposals, I think, would have a huge impact. I can go on and on. I will tell you that with Race to the Top and some of the other proposals that are out there, they feel like they are being scrutinized, evaluated, judged, publicized, when they don't have the resources that they need. So I would ask you to think about, what do you really have to do this year? Certainly, you have to balance the budget. But the policy decisions that you make are going to possibly have a huge impact on people who are feeling incredibly stressed. So that's my first point. We were not included in this discussion about how to reduce budgets or change budgets. Okay, so that's fine, but that gives me the opportunity to be a little more critical. If you take a look at the number two under the flexibility in the event of state aid reduction, certainly Education Minnesota would be very opposed to that because people have made plans for the year, for their contract, and if a district has an idea as to what they're going to be cut, by the time the deadline comes around. It used to be June 1st, and the argument was made, they wanted July 1st. We fought hard against it, we lost. And why did they say it should go to July 1st? Because by July 1st, they would be able to make decisions based on what the legislature outcomes were. So if that's the case, then July 1st should work just fine for them, and there is no need to change it. And pair that with another bill that's out there that would allow school districts to determine when a teacher is off of probationary status at any time prior to the 3 years. If you put those two together, you have then created a very interesting scenario. Number three, waiving the maintenance of effort requirements to provide school districts maximum flexibility in reducing staffing levels. We're talking here about the licensed support professionals. The counselors, the social workers, the nurses. Do you really want to do that when our students are facing probably one of the most trying times in their lives in terms of job loss in the family, other factors relating to the budgets in their family, loss of health insurance because of some actions possibly at the legislature or because of job loss? This is a time when actually you should be, if anything, increasing the funding for those support services for kids. January 15th contract settlement deadline was mentioned, and I know I better cut this off because I promised to be brief. I sometimes wonder why people propose things that they do. Do people understand the impact of eliminating the January 15th deadline? Have they looked at the statistics? I have shared the statistics with certainly Madam Chair, and actually the January 15th contract settlement deadline, the closer you get to the deadline, the smaller the settlements are, and we've got the data to prove it. So again, I ask everybody to take a deep breath. Think about the long-term implications on the decisions that you're making, and in some ways, well, just fixing the budget deficit as you need to do is appropriate, but I want you to think long and hard about the policy changes that you make, that some, yes, indeed, will have fiscal impact. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And it was kind of counterintuitive, the information that Education Minnesota provided. If you haven't all seen it, ask Ms. Allswiger for it, but showing that the closer to the January 15th date contracts were settled, the lower they were settled at, which, you know, is contrary to what our perception is. Representative Saylor, you and the Superintendent Doach, rhymes with coach, I put down here so I can remember it, are here, and we welcome you, and
I think that the
conversation that you've heard the bulk of it kind of really leads into this presentation. So, Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm so pleased to be able to have invited Superintendent Doach down today to talk to all of you, because it's absolutely what you want to hear about, what all of us want to hear about, as we are really undertaking serious rethinking of all of our systems in the state. And I know the four-day school week has been a concept that's been around for a little while, and I remember when Black Duck School first started talking about it, and, you know, the conversations within the community, the conversations in the whole area. And I'm not going to take a lot of time because you want to hear from him, but I do want to also say that was it last night?
Yes.
That Superintendent Doach was addressing the Clearbrook-Gonvick School, because other schools in the area want to hear what's working for Black Duck. And I congratulate Black Duck for their forethought in realizing that as one of those school districts in the northern two-thirds that is having and has had severe troubles with referendums, that just isn't part of how they're going to be able to deal with things. So they had to come up with something different. That's what this is. And I'll leave it to Superintendent Doach. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Saylor. Superintendent Doach, welcome. And members,
you,
there is a handout in your packet if you want to turn to that. Superintendent Doach.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start by giving just a little bit of history, and I was at one point going to show a slide presentation, but these worked out so well here. You can look over these and we'll go into those in just a few minutes. But we started a few years ago trying to pass a referendum. We have 56% free and reduced in our school. The referendums we've tried to pass in the last couple of years, my budget, by the way, is about $7 million. So when you're talking about all the other monies up here, $7 million is just a little tiny bit in comparison, but the kids are just as important. We have 57% free and reduced. We, at this point, have a dollar referendum. $1. I think the average referendum is somewhere between $800 and $900, and that one will expire. And again, we've gone for two referendums in the past and lost 3-1. So then what we started to do was started to cut staff. And so we've cut about $1.5 million over the last 8 years. And now we're running into more issues monetarily. We had to step back and try to think outside the box, as was mentioned here earlier, redesign a little bit. So the board told me, they said, Bob, we want you to go and research the four-day week. So I spent about 2 months researching the four-day week. How do you spend 2 months? Well, you go into Google, and if you start looking in Google and reading everything, it's going to take you probably 4 months. So I pick and chose the ones that were important for me to read. And I called all different regions of the United States to talk to different school administrators about the four-day week that they once ran or are running now. And after putting all that information together, I sat down with my board and I gave them the information that I had come up with. And they said, okay, let's go for a four-day week, and we can use this as kind of a last resort. We have nowhere else to go after this. We can't pass a referendum. We can't cut any more teachers. Per dollar, our employees are cut. There isn't anything left for us to do. So we decided to go with that. And so we had our meetings, our public meetings, as per requested. You have to have three of those. And we went with it. What I told the community as I spoke, though, at all the different meetings, and last night when I spoke, I reminded people, this is just a Band-Aid. This is a small amount. You know, the state is either going to have to come and give us some more money, or we're going to have to pass a referendum. And neither of those are, it doesn't look like either of those are going to happen. So what does Black Duck do, close the doors? No, we don't. We went to a four-day week, and we projected we'd save $70,000. Right now, we're sitting at $125,000. So money-wise, it's a success. The biggest question people will have here is, academically, what can you tell me about the school academically? I've talked to the teachers. We do map testing, which we don't do three a year. We do two a year, and we haven't done the second one yet. But the big test that everybody looks at would be the MCAs. You're familiar with the MCAs, of course, and we'll be taking those very soon, and we'll be looking at our scores probably in July. Over the past few years, we've been the highest scoring school in our area, and I'm very, very, very proud of that. And I hope it doesn't go down. But the teachers themselves have said, as far as curriculum is concerned, we're right where we were last year at this time or ahead. And in terms of tests and grades that the teachers are giving the kids, they say they're right on target. There have been four studies done on the four-day week in terms of academics that I've read. One was back in the 80s. One was in the 90s, one was 202, and one was 206. All four of those studies say that scores do not go down. They stay the same or go up. Okay? I don't know what Black Duck's going to do. I don't know in terms of scores. I have no idea. I'm not going to tell people. I was asked yesterday, can you guarantee that the scores are going to go up? No. Can you guarantee they're not going to go down? No. I have to wait and see. It's an experiment. We're able to save $125,000. If you look at McRae, and I'm just going to jump into there for a second, they saved about $190,000. Okay? You have War Road and Ogilvie, and I haven't talked to those superintendents lately, so I don't know where their savings is at. But we also did surveys. We did one in October, and then we did one recently of the parents. We did one of the parents, and in the high school, 91% of the parents said it was a good thing. Now, you have to remember, this is only of the surveys we received back, because not everybody's going to send their survey back. We all know that. 91% of the surveys that were sent back said this is a good thing in the high school. 84% in the elementary school said it was a good thing. The businesses, we sent it out to every business in town, and 75% of the businesses said it was a good thing. The kids themselves, about 85% of them said it was a good thing. And of course, the teachers, if you're sitting down at the coffee shop discussing school, the coffee shop people are going to say, well, the teachers love it. Of course, they get another day off. But that's not the case, because we have the same amount of minutes per week as we had last year in a five-day week. In fact, we have more time because our teachers in the high school gave up some of their prep time to equal out the amount of time so every class could be increased in the high school by 10 minutes. We didn't have to cut electives. We didn't have to decrease class or increase class sizes. Morale is better. Discipline is better. Overall, and again, I can't talk to the MCAs, the academics from the MCAs. I don't know. We'll see when the time comes. But it seems to me that the teachers, when I have talked to them, believe honestly that it's going just as good as it was before, if not better. So that's just a quick overview, talking a million miles an hour. Does anyone have any questions about it at all?
Did you advise North Branch that they're recently apparently going into it as well? Did they consult with you?
Yes, they did. Yes, okay. They did. They called me, and at the time they wanted, I wasn't available, so they went and called McCray. I did talk to the superintendent and told her some of the good things that were going on, and I know she talked to McCray, and they went for it, and the board has voted for it, I believe, and now they have to be accepted by the State Department. So,
thank you. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent Dosh, can you tell me, I'm looking at this slide here where it says estimated savings.
Yes.
And I get the bus fuel and I get the substitute teachers. I don't get the salary savings of $53,000. Okay. What? Can you explain that a little bit?
Superintendent Dosh.
Yes, I can. Thank you. The salaries, what we did was I took hourly employees and cut everybody back. I cut the custodial staff back, cut the cooks back, cut our paras back, housekeepers back. Of course, that involves bus drivers too, because they're not going to be working as many days. So when I cut everybody back, the savings from that was $53,000.
Representative Ward.
Thank you.
So Superintendent Dosh, it was not teachers and it was all the other staff.
Yes, the teachers this year did take a soft freeze. It was a little over 1%, and that's steps and lanes.
Okay, Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Superintendent. In terms of your extracurricular activities, Mondays that you didn't have classes, were they allowed to practice, perform?
Absolutely. We still have
Superintendent Dosh.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the
rules
yet.
We have our
procedures. I'll get them. I'll get them. Okay, thank you. Yes, we still have practice on Mondays, and very often it's longer than practices on the other days. We have changed practices. The difference is about 15 minutes from last year. They're shorter, except sometimes they make up for it on Mondays. What we felt is the coaches have to use their time a little bit more efficiently, because they do this, they do this, they do this, they run these, all these different drills and so forth and so on, and the kids are gone.
Thank you.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent Dosh, I have a question on prep time. You said the high school teachers gave up some prep time. It is my understanding, and I've had a long-standing question about this, and I should just look it up one of these days, is that prep time is dictated by the state, and that we have some stipulations on it that, for example, prep time has to be in the middle of the day as opposed to the end of the day. And so I am wondering, did you do any sort of manipulation with that and saying, you're really giving up some prep time, but on the other hand, now you've got Friday as prep time or anything like that, Monday. Could you just speak to me that a little?
Superintendent Dosh.
Yes, thank you. The teachers decided themselves to round out the hours, we have 7-hour days, so every class could go from 50 to 60 minutes to give up the prep time. There was no question when we sent the minutes into the state, so we didn't have an issue with it. The teachers didn't have an issue with it, so we did it.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that got approved by the state, by the Department of Education?
Mm-hmm. Superintendent Dosh.
The minutes, we put the minutes together, they looked at it, and they okayed it. We didn't say specifically on application, the teachers are taking a 5-minute cut to their prep time. We did not say that.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One other question then on, did you ever entertain the thought of what about not having school in the middle of the week? And just the only reason that I say that is because I think that there are other ways that you can maintain learning and accelerate learning, and a middle of the week day off, I could see very easily where teachers, if they have student contact on Tuesday, could give learning activities for Wednesday And then the next day, if they come back, it's very much easier to hold them accountable for learning, the independent learning that they were to do either at home or outside the home. Did you give any thought to that,
Superintendent Dosh?
Yes, we did discuss it. The board discussed it, and they decided that we were going to give the people a three-day weekend in case someone wanted to go somewhere. But yes, Wednesday was discussed.
So, Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I give you great credit for this very creative way of dealing with a horrible situation. But my question has to do with parents of, let's say, first graders. It strikes me as an awfully long day. Class beginning at 10 minutes after 8, and the end of the day coming at 20 minutes after 4, factoring in rural country lifestyles and bus times. Have you gotten any pushback from parents in the primary grades?
Superintendent Dosh.
Very, very little. As a matter of fact, this is kind of interesting to me. The little kids accepted it better than the big kids.
They always do.
The little kids maybe didn't know any better. I don't know. We have some parents that have had some concern. We had two families in the fall pull out because of the four-day week. Okay? They thought it was too long for the kids. And we have occasionally others coming in. Now, saying that, but it's not a lot. We don't have real big issues with it. In fact, kindergarten, I was just talking to the kindergarten teacher the other day, and I was asking her about rest time in the afternoon. She said, we've eliminated it. They're doing so much reading and so much math that we just skip right over it, and they do it all day long. So I think the teachers believe it's working well.
Representative Mariani.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Superintendent Dolch. It's good to see you again. Just a clarification and two questions. I'll do this really quick. The clarification, just to show you that I don't always listen as closely as I should. The estimated savings, we're talking about, this is one academic school year, or what's the period of time?
Superintendent Dolch.
Yes, it's one school year, okay. $125,000, and that's without... Well, I put on here without the lighting and without fuel and without water and sewage. So I suspect it's going to be closer, to 150.
Okay.
That's over 1 year.
Thank you. And Madam Chair and Superintendent Dosh, the what we've learned so far slide talks about daycare has not been as big a factor as anticipated. I'm wondering if you can say a little bit more about that. Obviously, we don't create, we don't provide for K-12 education as a daycare, surrogate. But in fact, socially, it's how many people live their lives. It's it's a trusted place where their kids are at. How is that not an issue for your parents, and how do you know that?
Superintendent Dosh.
Last year, it was the biggest issue we had during my meetings. When we sent out a survey this year, 7% of the people that returned the survey said it was still an issue. Most of them had taken care of it. A lot of people were having daycare from 3:30 to 5:30, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, mm-hmm. Thursday, Friday. And that's 10 hours. Now they just have daycare on Monday, and that's 8 hours. So actually some of them are saving money. But as far as asking the community, it's not as big of an issue. It still is one, but only 7% of the people claim that it continued to be an issue.
And then, Madam Chair,
Superintendent,
the last question, and it's kind of related to this one. Your second slide says a Band-Aid, not a cure. I'm looking at some of the results under the research with fewer absences, better attitudes, obviously the money savings. one can look at this very simply and say, well, you know, that looks like a pretty good deal. Why don't we just stick to that? So what's the why just a Band-Aid and not a cure?
Superintendent Dosh.
The reason I call it a Band-Aid is it's not enough money. It's not enough of the savings. If, in fact, we were to go back to a five-day week, we'd have to cut 2.5 teachers, okay, to make up for that. Mm-hmm. And I see in years to come, specifically with the 2773, you know, we're going to lose about $800,000 if we don't get the 27. So it's just a small-time fix, mm-hmm, if the big monies continue to go away.
Thank you. We have one more legislator on the list who I'm going to call on in 1 second. Is there anyone else in the audience that wanted to testify on this topic? Ms. Ciccone, okay? Anyone else? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'll make this quick. Superintendent Dosh, you talked about the actual school day, and I'd like to ask about the school periods, especially for high school kids. They're 10 minutes longer. And you think about teachers instructing for a certain length of time, and then you have time to work on your homework. Does it get to be actually more time instructing or more time to work on homework with that longer class?
Superintendent Dosh.
Both. Easily said. I know that the biology teachers, the science teachers, the physics teachers, the art teachers, they get more time with hands-on materials, okay? When you work on the reading, writing, it's more time for that type of activity. All the teachers have said that they feel strongly that this extra 10 minutes is a positive. It's not, you know what, when it comes to 40 minutes done with the class, they're not hurrying that last 10 minutes to get to 50 minutes to get everybody out on the move to the next class. They go to 50 minutes, 55 minutes, and then they get going on. So they feel according to what they've told me, that they get a lot more work done with the kids, and it's really effective and efficient.
Okay. Before you go, I think you've made it clear that this wasn't the first choice of the Black Duck School District, and we've complimented you, and you certainly should be complimented for coming up with a creative solution when we haven't provided enough money for the students. And you've also said that 2.5 teachers would have to be cut to go back to the five-day week. And in this committee, I think it was last week, we had a report from the legislative auditor that showed us that extended time, like summer school, after school, longer school year, weekend school, actually makes a difference for students who are at risk. We weren't terribly surprised. But we had documented evidence that is the case. And I'm wondering if you do anything with this four-day week to mitigate it for students who are struggling, who might be the sort that the legislative auditor singled out, who do benefit hugely. It was actually a huge benefit, much more. We all expected it to be a benefit, but it was a startling a result in terms of how much more they benefited from this time on task. And I'm wondering, do you have any ability, or is that not within your funding ability, to have kids who are struggling have a little more time? Superintendent Dosh.
We have a class that we have put in recently called Credit Recovery. Mm-hmm. And, of course, with that being a lengthier class, more kids are able to come in and work in that class. We also have VOTEC construction class. We build houses every year, and a lot of the at-risk kids are in there and staying in there because they have longer time to work with a hammer and work with a saw and work with the electrical wires and so forth. So I do believe that we've saved some kids because of the length of day and because of the programs we had to offer.
Thank you. And if any of you haven't seen that program, I had a chance to go there 3 or 4 years ago with Representative Saylor, and that's an incredible program, what the students are learning. They were building a real house that somebody was going to live in once they finished, and so that's an amazing program. Representative Zelzer, you have one more question.
Real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us what your K-12 enrollment is and how close, in terms of miles, the closest school district is to Black Duck?
Superintendent Dosh.
We have 642 kids.
Okay.
Our square miles are 426 square miles. We run 11 bus routes. Our closest school district probably is Kellyer. And I can't tell you how many miles it is. I don't know.
Representative Enzel.
About 75?
No. No. Because I can travel there in 40 minutes.
Okay. 50.
Okay. I think we're into gambling again now, it seems to me.
Yeah.
Representative Enzel.
Madam Chair and members, what this tells this rural member who represents 8 small rural districts of around that same enrollment, that this is really and truly an option for our rural districts. I wouldn't have said this when I came here to the legislature in January of 07, but what is going on in Black Duck really is, I believe, an option.
Thank you very much, and that's a good closing comment. Thank you so much, Representative Saylor, for bringing Superintendent Dosh. I think we've learned a lot, and we'll be very much looking forward to your test scores when you get them.
So will I.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, yes. And committee. Thank you very much.
Ms. Ciccone. Welcome.
Hi. Good afternoon. Mary Ciccone with Parents United. I'm just a little alarmed by the way that the conversation's been going, and I wanted to point out a couple of things. First off, while every other developed country in the world is adding time in their schools, we're sitting in this room applauding less time. I would contend that we could save more money if schools would simply move to 3 days, and I would contend that we could get a state surplus if we moved to 2 days. I think it's important to know that in 2004, 28% of the total state budget was used for schools. Today, that's 26%. It's not just the costs are going up. The state has absolutely reduced the money that it's put in education. John Myers in 2004 was asked the question, why would it cost $1 billion more to educate our kids? He said, it'll take this much to educate the average kid up to where they need to be, but it'll take this much more to educate the tougher populations. We know that the fastest growing portion of our E16 population are those toughest kids. I want to contend that in 2009, Decision Resources, at the height of the economic collapse, asked what the most important thing was in the metro area, and in their poll, it showed adequate funding for schools. Twice as many people who were concerned about taxes at the height of the economic collapse. And I would lastly contend that there is indeed a cure. It's the cure that we all use, and it's called additional tax. So while we sit and wonder how we can live within the dollars we have, which I contend is absolutely important, this body is charged with looking ahead at the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ciccone. We always, I get very inspired to listen to Parents United always, and I think that's a good way to end our meeting, with reminding ourselves that we're looking at lesser solutions, and there's a much better one, and it includes not being confined by current circumstances. So if there are no announcements or questions, Representative Benson, you had your hand up a while ago.
Thank you. I just had a quick question for Representative Dabney and his interesting discussion of the Missouri lottery proposal. I'm just wondering if Representative Dabney and Enzo would, if we adopted it, insist on equalization if YZ are one, for example.
And I don't think it's...
I got two boxes.
No, but Representative Dabney is always quick. He has an answer. The meeting is adjourned.